I want to thank you this morning for your generosity. A few weeks ago, I told you that we were running behind on our budget. We were $30,000 behind on our budget this year, and in a few short weeks, we are now down to just $8,000 behind. So this community has really stepped up and been generous, and I want to thank you, all of those who give regularly all the time. Thank you, those of you who decided to help out as well. Thank you very much, and we're getting there. We're hoping for a great end of the year, and that we can get to the place again where we can start dreaming together as a tribe, as a church together. So thank you for that. I appreciate that. I want to talk this morning about tribes. I don't know if you've ever been in a situation where you immediately sort of sense these people are not my people. A couple summers ago, I was traveling with my good friend Riley and John, and Riley actually has an uncanny resemblance to Father Chipsmas. It's a little odd. But we were traveling together, and we had come out of Colorado, and we were in the north of Utah, and Riley's like, he's kind of whiny sometimes. He's like, I really want to stop at a place. We had some time on our hand. I want to stop at a place that has some natural hot springs, and that stuff's sort of more native to Colorado. I was like, I don't want to stop. Like, that just sounds annoying, trying to find one of these places. So he starts looking up on his phone, and he finds, he's like, oh, I found this place called Mystic Hot Springs. Could we spend the night there? And I was like, ah. But, you know, he's a friend, so, you know, you do what you do. So we stop at this place, and the moment we pulled in, I had some serious misgivings about this place. There was about 30 hippie vans. There was a pool that was empty with, like, 40 chickens in it. It just looked like a complete dive dump, and we checked in, and we got our little campsite, started asking around. And the story was that these group of people had been touring around with the Grateful Dead. They'd been following them, and 30 years ago, they were following the Grateful Dead. They found these hot springs, and they just decided, this is it. We're going to just park here for the rest of our lives. And so they've been there for 30 years after giving up following the Grateful Dead. And we're also in North Utah, which is kind of Mormon country, but we're not close to Salt Lake. It's like backwater Mormon country where you suspect there could be, well, some interesting marital setups going on there. And so we've got these Grateful Dead hippies and this Mormon weird vibe, and so finally we decide to get into the hot springs. And I got to be careful here because I got some neighbors who have a hot tub, some new neighbors that are going to have a hot tub, and I want to make sure that I still get invited there. But I got to say, is it not a bit weird when you get into hot boiling water with strangers? It can be a bit odd. And we got in there, and the locals, they seemed just so excited that there were new people around, and they're like, hey, you should stick around. And we're like, nah, we're just passing through. And they're like, well, this could be a place for you. We could use more, a few good men around. I'm like, this is getting freaky. It was just the whole time I was there, I'm like, these people, they're not my people. This place seems strange, and it was a very strange encounter. But I'm interested by this idea how you can you know fairly quickly in a setting, kind of like, I'm not sure this is my tribe, or yes, this is my people. You know, back in 2008, I read a curious little book by marketing guru Seth Godin. A book is called Tribes, and I love this little book. I'd probably place it in perhaps one of my top 25 books that's influenced my thinking. I love it. It's short, it's simple, and it has this enlightening premise. The idea of the book is simply this: humans always have and always will organize themselves into tribes. And if you can understand that, you can understand the human psyche on a much more profound level. Now, of course, Godin wants to use this knowledge to help people leverage and market their products. Fair enough. But I love this book because it opened my eyes to the idea that how we organize ourselves into tribes. And since reading this book, I've become obsessed with the idea of tribes. I see them everywhere now. This is how Seth Godin defines a tribe. A tribe is a group of people connected to one another, connected to a leader, and connected to an idea. For millions of years, human beings have been part of one tribe or another. A group really only needs two things to be a tribe: a shared interest and a way to communicate. shared interest in a way to communicate. And when you think about and consider the ways the internet has transformed our society in the last 20 years in terms of the way we're able to communicate, you realize that not only are humans inherently tribal, but our tribal identities have only been magnified because we can communicate with anyone, anywhere, anytime. And most of us today have several tribal identities. There's a tribe today for virtually any interest imaginable. For instance, I was talking to John Benjamin's recently, and his backyard connects to a park, and he tells me that every week there are these people, cosplay people, who show up in costumes with Nerf weapons and fight each other. Grown adults meeting in the park in character costumes and fighting each other. Awesome. Right? I'm not making fun of it. I'm just saying I want an invite. I don't know how to get into this tribe. Sounds awesome. Or I was telling Kristen recently, we were talking about Christmas. We don't need anything, except I was like, you know what? I want a bonsai tree. I want a bonsai tree bad. You know those little, you like snip a thing on the tree like once every 3 months. You're just crafting. Have you heard of these little trees that look like big trees? I think that'd be great. I want one to get more zen-like in my office. She's a bonsai tree. Who does that? I was Googling it. There's a bonsai tree society in KW. There's like a famous bonsai tree guy that lives in Breslau, and he's got YouTube videos with like 500,000 hits. What a weird little tribe that is. One of my favorite forms of reading is reading nonfiction books about bizarre tribes. One of my favorite books is Confederates in the Attic. It's about interesting, odd people in southern states. And one of the stories that they follow is Civil War reenactors. These people spend their vacations dressing up and reenacting Civil War battles. It's like that's how they spend their time. Or I think perhaps my favorite book on this is it's called Moby Duck, and it's the story of true story. January 10th, 1992, a container ship was in the Pacific Ocean, and there was a big storm, and one of the shipping containers got washed overboard. The shipping container happened to be carrying 28,800 rubber duckies, and it burst open, and now there's 28,000 rubber duckies somewhere in the ocean. And for the past 20 years, there's a whole tribe of people. Every time they get a day off work, they hit some weird beach looking for these rubber duckies. It's just amazing. What do you do with your time? I look for rubber duckies. I mean, that's just a... Or Norwegian wood. That's a tribe I'm a part of. It's the art of stacking wood in the Norwegian way. I'm a part of that tribe. I like to stack wood. That's a weird thing to do, right? And it's a weird thing today because there are millions of different tribal affiliations that you can belong to, and it can be innocuous, like how you stack wood or chasing rubber duckies, but it can also be much more serious and consequential. Tribal things like religion and politics and ideologies, we're tribal creatures. And what I want to ask and sort of explore this morning is, how do we think about that? Is Nexus a tribe? How should a tribe like Nexus define itself? What I want to do this morning is explore tribalism a bit through the lens of Scripture. And the first thing I would say is that the Christian path in Scripture is pictured as a tribe that transcends tribal thinking. It's a path that completely dismantles any sort of, or tries to any sort of, us and them thinking. The ultimate vision of the Christian path in Scripture is an embracing of all humanity as one big tribe. I mean, you look at the sort of hypnotic scenes in Revelation, one of them in Revelation 7:9. After this, I looked and behold, a great multitude that no one could number, from every nation, from all tribes and peoples and languages, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed in white robes with palm branches in their hands and crying out with a loud voice, "Salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb." This idea carried in Scripture that the Christian path is a tribe that transcends tribalism. It's for everyone everywhere, no matter tribal allegiances. The Apostle Paul does further work on this, right? He envisions the church as a body of people where the antagonisms and rivalries of tribal thinking are left behind. And so he coaches, right, the church, the animosities between Jew, Gentile, rich, poor, slave, free, male, female. You can extrapolate it from there. Those are to be done away with. And then there's, of course, Jesus, whose primary ethic is the golden rule. Love your neighbor as yourself, which is probably the most anti-tribal ethic imaginable, particularly when we allow Jesus himself to interpret what he means by that. What does he mean? Well, of course, he tells the story of the Good Samaritan and speaks of it in his own words in the book of Matthew. Travel the Christian path, of course, is to love your enemies. Do not resist an evil person. I love how St. Sulon of Mount Athos sums it up. We only know God to the extent that we love our enemies. Love that line. There's one you can chew on for a while. We only know God to the extent that we love our enemies. And if that's the case, then we suggest this: the church must be a place where we can actually encounter our enemies. And so you have this scriptural vision of a tribe of people who are transcending tribal boundaries. Yeah, I was having lunch this week with a couple, and they're asking me some questions about Nexus, and I get weirded out because I feel like when I'm on the seat answering questions, I've always ended up ordering the wrong food. And so I was out with them, and I had ordered Tom Yum soup. It was really spicy, and so they're asking me questions. My nose was running. I had like 10 dirty Kleenex beside me, like, oh yeah, let me tell you about Nexus. It was just gross, but I felt bad. But they were saying to me, Brad, explain like this vision. And I basically was telling them what I just told you, this idea of a tribe that's beyond tribalism. And we were talking, and at one point they said to me, they said, Brad, that just seems so unrealistic. Eventually, a group of people need to take a side. Eventually, people will feel Nexus needs to point in one direction or another. And when that happens, it isn't realistic, Brad, to think that enemies might actually exist together in community. Especially today when we have a plethora of choices when it comes to churches. It's not realistic to think enemies might come together. And it was weird. It stuck with me all week. I was wrestling through that idea. Unrealistic. It just stuck with me in my head. I was thinking, you know what? Seth Godin would agree. Seth Godin would probably say to a church like ours, pick a niche, pick a tribe, speak to that. And so I kept thinking, this is unrealistic. But what I kept coming over to, I think again and again this week, was this: I'm not sure I give a damn anymore about realistic. Because I don't know about you, but when I signed up to walk the Christian path, it wasn't because I thought it was realistic. My guess is, for those of you in the room who would consider themselves Christian, you didn't either. And so I'm tired of realistic, how realistic it is for certain people to get together, existing with the other, submitting our personal and tribal identities, our personal and tribal preferences, in order to show love, mercy, compassion, loving enemies, ending antagonisms. I mean, none of that seems easy or realistic. But without that grand vision, I'm not sure what the point is, what we're doing here. And so it's always been the vision of the Christian path to be expansive. And I think any church worth its salt has to pursue this ideal as best as it can. Unfortunately, I don't think a lot of churches even try. Even still, how do we come down from the clouds? We're tribal people. So how do we make sense of our tribal instincts while trying to live in this grander vision of the Christian path? Well, I think I would start by saying this: belonging to a tribe is a double-edged sword. And part of the reason that we're hardwired for tribes is is because having a tribe gives us a home. It gives us a place of community. It gives us a sense of belonging. And that is a good thing to be celebrated. I just read this week a fascinating book, Sebastian Younger's book called Tribe on Homecoming and Belonging. And it's a fascinating book because Younger, in the book, he's trying to unravel this riddle. He was a war vet from Afghanistan, and as he reflected on his time there, he thought to himself, he's never experienced a more powerful community sense of belonging than when he was at war. And what happened is when he came home, he suffered from PTSD, incredible loneliness, anxiety, and he knew many others were as well. As he was trying to unravel this riddle, why did he feel so at home, a sense of belonging at war, and when he got home, such a sense of isolation? And so the book is fascinating. He scours history for the answers, and what he finds is kind of bizarre. His theory is this: we humans are not suited for the kind of individualism we live with today in North America. And he argues this: humans are happiest when we're part of a tribe. But the disturbing paradox for him is this: tribes flourish the most when there's turmoil, suffering, and conflict. We never feel like we belong so much when we're fighting someone or when we've suffered from a natural disaster. He says this: it's often in the midst of chaos and war that we develop our deepest sense of belonging. So he says there's a bizarre tension here. We need tribes, we need belonging, but often that belonging exists on the back of conflict. Tribes are good, but the evil of tribalism can't be ignored. So what do you do? What do you do with that? I've been thinking about this. I feel the first thing we need to do is just be very, very honest with ourselves. We have tribes, and we belong to tribes, all of us. And while those tribes might provide us a sense of home and belonging, every tribe comes with dangers. And I think it's sometimes easy to allow ourselves to think that we love all humanity. I just love everyone. But I think the reality is this: we're not hardwired to be able to love everyone. We're hardwired for tribes. So I think it starts simply with, let's just be honest. But let's also be honest about this: belonging to a bonsai tree tribe might be fairly innocent, but today many of our tribal affiliations are based around, I would say, morals, ideologies, politics, religion. And the psychologist Jonathan Haidt, one of the things he says is moral tribes are virtually impossible to overcome. And why? Because he says this: overcoming our moral tribalism feels immoral to us. It feels like we're compromising. It feels like we're giving support to people we see as morally bankrupt, or giving support to people we see as oppressors. And well, screw those people. And so the dangers of tribalism, it's not a left or right thing. It's not a religion thing. It's not a politic thing necessarily. It's a human thing. So acknowledging that we're tribal, I think, is the first step. We have tribes, and it's almost impossible to overcome them. So what's the way forward? Well, I want to betray my Enneagram 6 nature here. Anyone else in Enneagram 6? No one. Oh, one. We 6s have trouble with trust. We don't trust very easily. So my first recommendation this morning is going to be very Enneagram 6-like. Then I'll back it up. But how do we think about tribalism and the fact that we need tribes and yet there's dangers to them? The first thing I would say is this: never trust a tribe. Never trust a tribe. Because tribes so quickly can move towards our worst instincts as humans. Never trust a tribe of people. I mean, you see it even in just sort of innocent ways. You've been to a hockey game. It's great that the sport of hockey is moving on from fighting, but it's the most bizarre thing when you're into hockey, and normally any day of the week, the thought of an 18 and 19 year old men fighting would be abhorrent. You'd think that's disgusting. And yet on the ice, two people start fighting and you're like, oh, punch him, get him. Stand up, the crowd, the tribe is speak into that, the echo chambers of tribalism that can speak into our worst nature. And so I'd say never trust a tribe. And I want to, for a moment, consider the cross, Jesus' death on the cross, because so often I think what we do when we consider the cross is we ask ourselves questions like, what does this mean for salvation and forgiveness? What does this tell us about Jesus or God? But I want to, for a moment, consider what the cross says about us. What does the cross say about humanity? And I cite Richard Beck a lot, and I'm just going to come out and say it. He's one of the few people that makes sense to me today, so I like him. And he has this reflection on the cross that I think is powerful. The cross and tribalism. He says this: the cross was the moment when we looked God in the face and saw the devil. The cross was the moment when we looked at the light and called it darkness. The cross was the moment when we looked at innocence and called it criminal. The cross was the moment when we cursed and tortured love. That happened. We did that. Our moral confusion was so profound, north became south, west became east. And if that happened, how could we trust our tribe ever again? With the cross in the midst of us, can we ever be trusted when we say we see the devil in the face of others? The cross stands in the middle of our tribe and answers with an eternal verdict, no. Love that. Like I said, never trust a tribe, because tribes are very quickly see the devil in others, and we can't trust ourselves to see right. Our tribes can afford us a sense of home and belonging, which is great, but the cross reminds us that tribes are regularly capable of all sorts of evil. And we see that all the way from sports to neighborhoods to politics to faith and church. And I know some of you might be thinking, that's really cynical, Brad. If I can't trust a tribe, how can I ever belong to one? Well, let me temper my paranoia around trust a little and say, okay, be suspicious of tribe. Temper expectations. Or at the very least, insist on belonging to a self-critical tribe. A tribe, I think, needs to have the right questions and tools to sort of push back on our darkest impulses. And I think we need to insist that the tribes we belong to have the capacity for self-criticism. Without that, a tribe becomes incredibly dangerous. What does that look like? Well, here's what I wanted to do. I want to take you to the Old Testament prophets, and I was going to do both Amos and Jonah today, but I'm going to have to get to Jonah next week. It got too much. And I would say this, my thinking around Old Testament has dramatically shifted over the past 5 years. There are, of course, those who simply take the Old Testament at face value, which I think is concerning. But I'm well aware that in a room like this, there are many people who I would say probably can't seem to find anything good at all about the Old Testament, which used to be me. I was looking back through my teaching Nexus season 1-6 and how infrequently I went to the Old Testament because it just so confused me. I don't know what to do with it. I still don't know in many ways, but I've come to see the Old Testament to me is kind of like a fine wine. You know, when you're 19 years old and you start drinking or experimenting with it, and what does wine, a good wine, taste to you? It tastes disgusting, right? You're like, pass me the Mike's Hard Lemonade and vodka drinks, and you're like, all right. But the older you get, right, you start discovering with wine, with beer, with spirits even, that there are complexities. There are subtleties, tastes, and notes that can only be discovered with some experience. You taste a fine wine, and you're like, is that, I think that's blackberry. That's always my go-to. I never really know what I'm tasting with fine wine. I think I detect blackberry. Cinnamon? I don't know. You got to be careful, because people, they'll know if you know your wine real quick. But this is what I've sort of come to think of the Old Testament. The Old Testament is a tribe in conversation with itself. And if you were to ask me, well, wait, Brad, are you saying the Old Testament is not God-breathed or inspired? I would say, no. I definitely, absolutely see it as God-breathed and inspired. I'm just understanding those ideas in very different ways. And so the Old Testament is a people and a tribe in conversation with itself about what it means to follow and know God. And within that conversation, you have self-critique. A tribe that is self-critical of itself and its own ideas. Let me illustrate what I mean through a bit of a weird imagination exercise. If I were a consultant for Donald Trump, and he asked me, "Brad, how can I play to my religious base so that I can build my wall?" First saying, "I don't know if I should be talking to you, Donald." Okay, I'll pay you a lot of money, Brad. I still wouldn't do it. But here's what I'd be thinking. This would be so perfect. If you go to the book of Nehemiah, chapter 2, verse 17, it says this. "Then I said to them, you see the trouble we're in? Jerusalem lies in ruins and its gates have been burned with fire. Come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem and we'll no longer be in disgrace." Wouldn't that be perfect? I'm like, you got people eating out of your hands with that verse. Substitute a little America for Jerusalem. Bob's your uncle. You got your wall. That's what I'd be thinking. But the interesting thing to me about Nehemiah is it represents a real dialogue going on in the Old Testament. Because when the people return from exile, if you're not aware, the people of Israel, they go into exile to Babylon. They're treated harshly. Their city of Jerusalem is completely destroyed. And when they get out of it, they return to Babylon. And the book of Nehemiah is basically a bit of a tribal identity booster. Come on, let's get together. Let's build the wall. Let's become strong again. Makes sense in that context. Let's rebuild ourselves. Let's return to our glory days. Be the most special tribe on the planet. And the thing is, tribes need that at times. But then there's the voice of the Old Testament, other voices that balance things out. Books, I would say, like Jonah. Definitely books like Amos. I'm going to skip, Brian, the next slide, but one of the best examples, I think, of self-criticism in the Hebrew scriptures is found in the book of Amos. But let me give you some background first. Amos is prophesying against Israel because everyone in Israel is a bunch of pretentious elites who think they're better than everyone else. And all the other nations are dimwits. And we have the right God. We got the right theology. We got the right morals, ideas, way of life. We're pretty special people. They're so smug. And Amos becomes the voice of self-criticism. He's trying to remind the people, you know what? You might not be so special. Their tribe is not nearly as superior as they might think. And Amos, it's a fascinating book, has a number of strategies for this. But the most brilliant one, the most interesting one, is found in Amos 9. This is God speaking to Israel with two questions. First one is this. "Are you not like the Ethiopians to me, O people of Israel?" says the Lord. Now, clearly, Israel's thinking, no, actually, not at all. Heck no, are you kidding us? We're nothing like the Ethiopians. We're way better than them. Notice what Amos is doing, saying, but no, you're not. Israel, you're, as a tribe, you're not so bloody special, you know? And Amos, as self-critique, is helping keep tribal identities in balance. And I would say this, we could use more of that today, from the mundane to the serious. "Are you not like the Boston Bruins fans to me, oh, you Maple Leafs fans?" Heck no. God, those pagans with their evil Brad Marchand. Not like them. "Are you not like the transgender community to me, oh, you Ontario Conservatives?" Heck no, we don't even necessarily think they exist. No, we're not like them. "Are you not like Jordan Peterson, Lindsay Shepherd, and Ben Shapiro to me, oh, you woke social justice warriors?" No. It's weird meat-eating people. No. They're bigots. They're backwards. "Are you not like the immigrant caravan to me, oh, you Republicans?" No, we're here legally. "Are you not like the Gospel Coalition to me, O Nexus?" Oh, don't get personal, God. No. Not like that. "You're not like the Southern Baptist to me, Nexus? You're not like Hillsong Church to me?" No. We're different. We're pretty cool here. "You're not like the Catholic Church, the Anglican Church to me, O Nexus?" No, they're boring. "Are you not like Franklin Graham to me, Brad?" Okay. No, just back off. I would never, ever put myself in that category, right? This is what Amos is doing. You're the same. And Israel, no, we're better. To which God says, get off your pedestal already. What Amos is doing is some internal self-critique. He's trying to undermine his own tribe. We're not that special. We're not that unique. He goes on, and this one is a real dagger in the heart. Did I not bring Israel up from the land of Egypt? Of course. And the Philistines from Kaphtor and the Arameans from Kir? Second question has two parts. Did I bring you up from Egypt, Israel? The answer is yes. In fact, that event is core to who we are. That's what makes Israel feel so special. That's our defining story. That's what makes us who we are. And Amos goes on and says, yeah, well, God did the exact same thing for the Philistines and the Arameans, your worst enemies. It's like, whoa, what? That was our story. We're special. No, God did it over here as well. You ever had a moment where you feel special and then not so special real quick? This was back in the day. Anyone remember Big Bucks in St. Catharines? That's quite the dance club there. Anyway, back when I was 19, I was in the dance club doing the thing, and that's always not a good situation for me because I don't got a lot of moves, but I was there, you know, it was a long time ago with some buddies, had a drink, you know, at the bar, putting out the vibe, and I was there, and a girl across the way, she looked at me in the eye, and she pointed and did this, which, I'm like, this never happens to me. Anyway, I'm like, all right. Now, the worst thing about a dance club is you can't walk over to people. You kind of have to dance, you kind of got to move. And so I'm sort of dancing over, which isn't good because I got 30 seconds of moves and then I'm done. So I use them all up trying to get over there. So I'm nervous and I'm kind of, I kind of got my move going. I got a little arm thing. That's my signature move, just the arm like this. It's good. It's really good. And I get there and I'm like, sweet, this is amazing. And I'm dancing with her a little and then I see her look over and go, what? And another guy comes up and starts dancing with her. I'm like, well, but I thought we were... whatever we were going to do, we were going to dance or something together. And she kept pointing at people, and people kept coming over until we had this, like, large dance thing, and then I just sort of slinked away into the back because I thought it was special. I thought of the hundreds of people there, she looked at me and said, you are the one to dance with me. But I realized she was really, no. And this is kind of what Israel's going through. Who? What other nation has been rescued from tyranny and slavery besides us? What God has dramatically rescued them from oppressors besides us? And Amos is like, well, we got some bad news. The specialness and uniqueness of Israel is so deeply rooted in their view of Exodus. It's so core to their identity. And then we realize God has performed other Exodus events. And not only just for other people, for the people they hate the most. And this is a deeply uncomfortable notion for them. I think it's an amazing idea for us to consider as well. I think what God is saying to Israel is this. You know, God has been engaging in acts of redemption that won't be found in the pages of your history books and your stories. And he says, God's work in the world cannot be reduced to the work we think we see God doing. God is at work in places we have no clue about, oftentimes with the people you consider enemies. And I think this is enough. It should give every church, every community pause. Erica spoke brilliantly last week about how we are God's beloved. And it was that's always a tough thing to talk about. She did a brilliant job at that. I want to echo that and say we are beloved. But I think the message here is this. You're beloved, but you ain't so special. Your tribe, it isn't the only one. And you see, what Amos is doing is he's undermining the dangers of tribalism, because tribes get dangerous when we start to think we're better, we're above, we're unique, we're special. And Amos comes along and is just cutting them right down to size. And the truth is this, tribes are inevitable. We need tribes. We need them to belong, to feel at home. And so, yes, we need them. But I say this, we better make sure our tribes have the voice of critique, the tools for self-critique. We better insist that our tribe tell stories of belonging and home. Our tribes tell the stories of Nehemiah, and we get all rah-rah and let's come together and do something special. But our tribes also better tell us stories about our own darkest impulses. Our tribe should tell us stories that knock us down a peg or two, stories that remind us God is at work in more ways than we can know. Stories that remind us we are no better than them. I'm going to ask the band to come and close us off here. But I've just been thinking about that, what it means for Nexus, because I got to be honest, I am tribal to my core. Like, I can get, even just sports, I get very competitive. I'm very tribal about Nexus. I talk to other people, I'm like, yeah, well, you're not as cool as us. You're not as, you know, you get very tribal. And I think one of the things we need to remind ourselves of is we're not better. We're not better than that other church. We're not better than that other community. We need to tell ourselves stories that increase our sense of belonging and home here. But we also need stories to remind us, you know what, we're one tribe among many, trying to do good work, trying to do the right things. Every tribe needs their Nehemiah stories, but every tribe also needs their Amos stories. And so next week, what I want to do is I want to move into the book of Jonah. I wanted to go there this morning, but that book is so crazy awesome. And we're going to unpack a little bit more, because Jonah is also critiquing his own tribe. In fact, what was the quote I heard this week? Something like, it's a miracle the book of Jonah made it into the canon and that the author wasn't burned at the stake. So, that's what we'll explore next week. For now, leave it with the band. Take us away. Thanks, Dave.